Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly, but it's a week off for our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson, who won't be joining us throughout the show as he prepares for the overnight shift next Monday, watching what he hopes will be the coronation of Arsenal as champions of the Premier League. But more on that later. First up, the A-League men's semi-finals are midway through and the Mariners' treble dream is alive after a chaotic night at a drenched Allianz Stadium against Sydney FC. While on Sunday afternoon, the Wellington Phoenix successfully parked the bus in front of the victory goal at AMU Park to set up a home tie next week, which may end up in the grand final the competition deserves. Joey Lynch from ESPN, The Guardian, and of course his Substack, if you haven't got onto that, make sure you do, to discuss that and also the breaking news of the past week. The clubs are staring down the barrel of a $1 million cut from the APL Central Distribution Fund cuts, which threaten the viability of the competition in its current format. Then we'll reflect on one of the great success stories of the English Premier League season, the emergence of Aston Villa as a contender at the top end of the ladder. It's easy to forget that after sacking Dean Smith, the much-loved manager who returned the Villa to the top flight, it all went wrong under Steven Gerrard. When he was sacked after less than 12 months in charge, the club were on the edge of the drop zone, safe on goal difference alone. Enter Unai Emery, a manager who had a point to prove, and prove it he has, with the club on the brink of Champions League football, a title they famously won in 1982. We'll take a look around all of that with Greg Evans from The Athletic. Edge, so much to talk about, but so many great news stories internationally with Australian football players in various top flight competitions.
Yeah, I'm going to talk in stoppage time later in the week. I'm going to talk about St. Pauli's promotion and the wonderful scenes in Hamburg. We'll go into depth about that. But I was captured by the Champions League, Rob, and I know we're going to talk about it in World Cup Corner, but I'll just give a little plug for it. Paris Saint-Germain, they blew it big time. They blew it big time. And how good is Borussia Dortmund? Are they just an old-fashioned football club that can take all before them? Yeah, amazing stuff. So I'm sure PSG and Bayern are licking their wounds. PSG for me, Rob, they blew it big time.
Oh, they did. And I just love the fact that Dortmund were one of the clubs that was the exact polar opposite of the Super League, playing against the very club who were the ringleaders of the whole thing, which is why I hope they end up winning the whole thing. What do you reckon?
Yeah, agree with you 100%.
What do I reckon, Rob? I reckon there's just a lot to be grateful for in Australian football this week. Jackson Irvine and Connor Metcalf at St. Pauli, Lydia Williams, what a career and a contribution. Harry Kewell up to his neck in an Asian Champions League final. We'll cover it all as we go. But we'll start with the A-League men's semis. The Mariners take a 2-1 lead into their home semi next weekend, having come from behind to defeat the Sky Blues in the rain at Allianz. Sydney are going to be without Jack Rodwell or Corey Holman for the second leg, while Jake Girdwood-Reich is under an injury cloud. Those first two names both red carded. Ultimately, it was Mikael Docker's penalty, that man again, which proved the difference on the night after Josh Nisbet pegged back Joel King's opener.
Andrew Redmayne, of course, dancing around on the line. He was penalty-saving specialist in 2019 in the finals. He guessed the right way, but Docker's penalty is too good. And the Mariners lead 2-1.
And as you said, Rob, victory and Wellington playing out a nil-all draw. Their third draw from four games this season, and they head across the Tasman with the Phoenix. A real chance of making their first grand final. We'll go in depth with Joey Lynch in a moment, Edge, but your takeaways from the semi-finals. We know that you've been pointed on the scheduling with the Mariners playing first on that quick turnaround from Oman, but once the games did start, what did you take from them?
Oh, that man again, Mitchell Docker, got the job done in the penalty. Fantastic. Look, just superlatives for Central Coast because, look, you know, I know what they've been through. I've organised everything for them over in Oman. So I know how tough it was for them to go to Oman and win and then come back and play on the Friday. They were hardly done by, and they got their noses in front. We'll talk to Joey Lynch. I think, Willem, Joey Lynch might think that Central Coast could have won by more. We'll see what he says about that. And Melbourne victory, I probably expected they should have got a little bit more out of that game at home. They dominated possession and a lot of shots on goal, but no chocolates for them. They've got to go to the cake tin, which will be bursting at the seams, Rob. Absolutely overflowing with Kiwis.
It will be massive. And, you know, talking to a good Kiwi mate of mine the other day, they, you know, as much as they haven't taken over New Zealand, obviously with Auckland coming into the competition, you know, some of the New Zealand football fans are not going to be that passionate about it. But I just think it's a great story with Giancarlo Italiano. And there was a chat before the match. I was watching some of the pre-match when he was asked if anyone he knew thought that the, you know, the club might do what they've done. And he said his mum was the only one, you know. So it's a great story.
Overflowing with Kiwis, Graham Arnold won't be brave enough to show his face there, would he, Edge? What about your man Rob Harry-Kewell and Yokohama F. Marinos? They also came from behind. They defeated LAN 2-1 in the first leg of the Asian Champions League final in Japan. Argentine manager Hernan Crespo watched his Emirati side take the lead on 12 minutes through Mohamed Abbas before Marinos turned things around through Asaka Uwaneka and Kota Watanabe. The return leg comes in Abu Dhabi in a fortnight. That is May 25. Marinos are chasing a maiden title while LAN are looking to add to their 2002 success, having also made the final in 2005 and 2016. And didn't he look the part on the touchline for the big occasion, Rob Harry? He looked elegant.
Well, he had
sartorially splendiferous. He looked good.
Yeah, no, we had the Harry, the Gareth Southgate vest on with the...
the three-piece.
Yeah, not the various colours, but it was well... Look, I think the thing I loved about it was that, look, there was... You know, the classic Japanese passion in the stadium, the constant singing, the chanting, the flags, the colour. But it looked like it wasn't going to work out to the viewer. But if you looked at Harry, he was never in any doubt that the game was still alive. And I thought, you know, this is going to go all wrong for him. They're trailing 1-0 late in the game, and they're going to have to travel to try and get a result away. But that turnaround late in the game, it was one of those things, Edge, where you see a manager who looks convinced that he had a plan to turn it all around, and he knew something that we didn't.
Yeah, it's a great result, but gee, I'm a bit nervous because I know where he's going for the away leg, and I know how stinking hot it's going to be, and I know that everyone will be sweating bullets over there, and I know how big this LAN club is. They are the king, the supreme ruler of United Arab Emirates. It's his club, his personal club. So, yeah, I know what they're walking into. So it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. But good on you, Harry. You're flying the flag for Australian football. You know what I like most about Harry's whole demeanour about all of this, Rob, is that he was very pointed in acknowledging that he is only a very small part of this achievement by his club. Really gracious in the way that he heaped praise on the former coaches and the playing group, and that he was just privileged to be there at the pointy end. So, yeah, he's well and truly making a mark already.
St. Pauli, as we head to Germany, will return to the Bundesliga after a 13-year absence, having sealed promotion with a game to spare, finally. Pauli fans stormed the Millantor Stadium field following their 3-0 win over Osnabrück on the same day that fellow North German club Holstein Kiel secured their promotion. So for skipper Jackson Irvine and his lieutenant in midfield there, Connor Metcalf, both central to their success. For Jackson, 26 appearances and 6 goals. He played 90 minutes in all bar one of those matches and now earns a chance, a very well-deserved chance, at a top five league for the first time in his career. And for Connor, 29 appearances, 3 goals and 5 assists, and at 24 is primed to take the next step. So Rob, fifth and fifth, but they were better than that in both of those seasons. Both of those were pretty disappointing, and now promoted in Jackson's 3 years at the club, and didn't he celebrate accordingly?
I did, and anyone who follows this show knows that we've got a very special connection with Jackson. I worked with his mum for 20 years, as Adam Maloney, our producer panel operator, did as well. We've known Jackson since he was a little fella, and famously sat in the stands in 2006 when Australia made that mighty run through the World Cup, and said to you know, some friends around, humbly at the time, that's what he wanted to do and that's where he wanted to be, and to watch him, you know, go through Ross County to go through the championship, Burton Albion, Hull City. I remember, you know, on my famous trip in 2018, watching him play for Hull City in that championship match against Wolves at the Molineux, and then to head over to Germany to what seems to be a club that was perfectly designed for him. The mature young man that he is, broader thinking, understands what football brings to the world. So to Jackson and to all his family, to his mum Danielle and his dad Steve, we're so happy for you. And you know, footballers, if they keep themselves in shape, Edge, they can have a long career. And look, not saying that he needs to go any further than what he already has, but it's going to be a lot of fun watching him in the top flight in the Bundesliga next season.
Oh, certainly is, and he's a frontliner for the Socceroos too. He's a very, very important part of their culture, and he really does understand the Socceroos journey and the importance of the national team. And of course, his whole family's rooted in the sport. I mean, he is football community to the bootlaces, Jackson Irvine. I mean, his grandfather with Dutch heritage was, you know, such a massive figure at Ringwood Wilhelmina, one of the big clubs in years gone by in Victoria, and his dad with his Scottish heritage.
And you remember I introduced his dad to Pelé, his grandfather to Pelé? You remember that story? That was one of
that story, yeah. But so. I'll tell you what, it's just so good to see him. I mean, one of the things that we reflect a lot on this program, but I don't think the wider Australian sporting public sort of connects with, is just the incredible experiences our national team players, whether they're men or women, whether it's Hayley Russo at Real Madrid or Samantha Kerr at Chelsea or Jackson Irvine at St. Pauli, they have incredible life experiences. Mm. Yeah, they make a fair bit of coin and set themselves up for life, but what about that experience, you know, being immersed in the St. Pauli community and such a cult club in Germany, and then, being a part of their promotion and being captain. You know, he'll be forever remembered as a huge part of that club. And, it's just, I mean, their life experiences are unbelievable. And, I just don't think the wider sporting Australian public sort of connects with just how significant some of these journeys of our international footballers are.
Roll into Socceroos and Matilda Central for the Green Gold Army Edge and ask you to expand on that a little bit more through the career of Lydia Williams. If the Olympics weren't important enough, this is going to be her international swan song. You can head to ggatravel.com.au and be a part of it. But it is, by the way, her birthday, her 35th birthday. So happy birthday today, Lydia. She started her career with the Canberra Eclipse and won her first Matildas cap aged 15 in 2005, 103 caps all told. And over the past few years has been, in a very modest and humble way, an outstanding deputy to the next group of goalkeepers that have come through. She's a proud Noongar lady, an Indigenous Australian, a pioneer really of the modern age of the Matildas, involved not just on the pitch but in the administrative side and the sort of the heavy battle of 2015 for women's rights in Australian football. A really, really good write-up by Emma Kemp in the Nine Papers, and we've given them a bit of a whack over the recent weeks, Rob, but absolutely worth the time to go and reflect on her career. So Edge, one of the absolute greats, going to play another season with the Victory, but for the Matildas, just about all said and done.
Well, she'll go to the Olympics as a backup, and who knows, with modern football, she might get an opportunity. But Lydia Williams, you know, it's a bit of an old cliche, Rob, isn't it? I haven't met anyone. I mean, no, and Rob, you guys know my involvement in the women's game. I haven't met anyone who says a bad word about Lydia Williams. She's a gun, and she does straddle a time when the sport was discriminated against, the women's football, and wasn't kosher and wasn't accepted. So she straddles that time with the emergence of the Matildas being, you know, one of the top line, if not the top line sporting brand in Australia at the moment. So good on you, Lydia. And her final message, I think we've got a grab of, which we'll play in a minute, but some of her words are special and what it means to play for Australia. Obviously, humble background. Her mum was American, so she has that American culture in her DNA as well, and she's such a lovely, happy person when you talk to her. And then obviously her dad's Indigenous, and that story is well documented. But I dipped my lid to Lydia Williams, a real, we talk about some big names in women's football, you know, the Heather Garriocks and the Julie Murrays and those types of people. But Lydia Williams, you're right up there. You are right up there.
And here is a little bit of that grab, Edge.
I've always wanted to leave the game better than when I first came in it, and I hope that I've had a a hand in that to build footballing in this country and especially with the Matildas. I love the team and I love the girls and I'm going to miss them so much. And I just hope that the level of support and love shown to the Matildas and to each and every single player continues. The hype continues to grow and hopefully it's left for the better. All good things come to an end, but I'm really excited to start my next journey.
Just to close out, Rob, around the grounds in the managerial department, Pete Klimovsky's FC Tokyo are running hot. After four consecutive wins, they drew 3-3 with Kashiwa Reysol on the weekend. They're up to fourth in the J1. Mitch Duke and Mashita Zelvia sit second level on points with Vissel Kobe. Mitch last week scoring his first J-League goal in 7 years. And in China, Kevin Muscat's Shanghai Port are starting to hit some cricket scores. 5-0, 6-0 and 5-2 since the start of May. So 16 goals in 3 games. They are second with a game in hand.
And just briefly, any more word on Muskie defying Ord, Willem?
I couldn't read any more of it, Rob. I actually didn't understand it, so I'll have to get back to you.
Jeez, you faked it really well last
year. Google
last
Translate?
Week. Yeah, Google Translate's perfect, but not for gossip around football managers. Anyway, we'll watch that space. It might happen, it might not. Okay, I'm going to take a little coffee break and listen to you guys have a yarn to Joey Lynch. We're in that sort of eye of the storm of the A-League men's semi-finals. We don't know how that's all going to play out, but what we do know is there's a great story about to emerge regardless. But we also know that there's a lot of money coming out of the game and a lot of it's related to a pretty ordinary television deal. We'll find out a bit more about all of that from Joey Lynch after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
The A-League men's competition should be looking towards next year's 20th season as cause for celebration, but instead, news that the APL's board and its clubs are at a stalemate over the Central Distribution Fund has shrouded the future once again in pessimism. Are things as bad as they seem? Whenever we've got that existential anxiety, we reach for the pragmatic, informed insights of Joey Lynch. You can read his work at jdlmedia.substack.com, a pioneer of the platform, some might say. Joey, welcome back to Box to Box.
Thanks for having me on, all. You give me far too kind an introduction.
Word of this Central Distribution Fund from board to clubs, garnered from the broadcast deal and a large basis of the salary cap, has been of concern from some time. And then last week, news broke that no agreement had been reached on the figure at an APL board meeting. Rumoured to have been a proposed cut from the 2 and a bit million we've been working with for a little while down to 1 million. And if we think back to the sort of now halcyon days of Fox Sports pre-COVID, this was a competition that ran on a $3 million salary cap. Is that accurate to your understanding? Can you flesh that out a little bit for us?
I cannot definitively declare that that is what the fund. I haven't been able to stand that up. Credit to Adam Peacock's reporting in Code for reporting that. A million has been the rumour for quite a number of months. You'd speak with people whenever you are able to get around the water cooler, be it at Socceroos games, Matilda's games, or just hanging out. Talk of a million has been bandied around there, so that when Adam did report it in Code, it didn't take me by surprise. It certainly, regardless of what the exact figure is, I have not heard anything to suggest that it won't be a significant cut on what it has been in the past. Certainly a cut on this year, to set aside what it was 5 or 10 years ago.
Can you please just explain to the punters, is this simply a relationship between broadcast income down to the salary cap and then outgoings and expenditure on that front, or are there more sort of variables in the mix here? So, you know, where else do clubs source income from, and how dependent are they on this money coming down?
Traditionally, broadcast revenue has sort of been, I guess, one of the core foundation pieces of club revenue sources. It's sort of been something that they can sort of bank on, say, all right, we know we are getting X amount of dollars this season, we will budget around that. It's why there was a bit of consternation earlier this season when clubs had set their budgets and there was a cut to the distributions communicated to them after that. There are, of course, the other traditional revenue sources that you would associate with footballing clubs, sporting clubs, gate receipts, sponsorship, unique in the footballing space as opposed to NRL and the AFL, the sale of players, which is inevitably going to have to be something that becomes a lot more important to clubs moving forward in the event that the distribution is cut. And also, if you are a club like the Central Coast Mariners this season, prize money from Asian competition. There is no prize money in the A-League men, but there is prize money in Asian competitions, the AFC Cup, the Asian Champions League. So one might argue that in light of everything going on in the Australian football space, the AFC Cup was a much more important trophy for the Mariners to win than the A-League Championship this year.
Joey, just while we're talking about the off-field stuff, I just want to test something with you. My network with the clubs is telling me, I just sense the temperature is rising as to the disgruntlement of the lack of transparency of the APL in particular. And now in my network, there are some clubs saying that they really don't know what's going on. And the continued silence of the leadership of the APL is creating frustration. What's your network telling you? Are you getting the same sense that the temperature amongst the clubs directed at head office is increasing as the end of this season closes and, you know, the hard decisions about next season's finances are coming home to roost?
I think there is definite frustration, and it's born from that clubs are losing money. Owners and the people behind clubs are losing money. And, you know, the people that can afford to be in a position to bankroll football clubs, they don't like losing money. It's how they got that money to begin with. So there is decided frustration surrounding that, particularly, I guess, from the clubs that don't possess seats on the Australian Professional League's board. We are in this situation where, ostensibly, you know, these clubs possess stakes in the Australian Professional Leagues, but they are not all sitting on the board of directors. They do not get that input. They do not get the same level of information. And I guess that's where a lot of frustration lies, in that it's not just the lack of information coming out of the people at the APL. And I think there's inevitably going to be some level of information that owners want to get from the APL, and the APL probably, it's just not feasible for the APL to give that every single day of the week. That's just sort of the gives and takes of why you appoint CFOs and CEOs and the like. But I think there's frustration there. Maybe the balance isn't quite right. And there's also a frustration with what's perceived as a two-tiered approach within the club. Some clubs are on the board, some are not. And those that are not, as you can imagine, get frustrated with that.
I thought the scheduling of the semi-finals first leg, I was absolutely gobsmacked that Central Coast Mariners were scheduled to play on the Friday night. And my mail is that they were seeding and they tried desperately to get it moved until the Sunday night or even the Monday because of obviously playing in that match in Oman. The APL said that they're all about putting football first, and good on Central Coast Mariners for getting their nose in front in the first leg, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But were you shocked at that decision? I just thought it was grossly unfair.
Shocked wouldn't be the right word. Nothing really shocks me in the A-League men's space anymore, to the point where maybe I sort of expect these things to happen purely because history tells me that I won't be let down if I take that sort of mindset. I thought that, to be honest, that to me sort of smacked of a situation wherein there were broadcasting requirements that the APL had to meet, and this was the only way that they could dance the dance that is stadium availability and the broadcasting time slots that they were given. Because ultimately, regardless of the health of the relationship between Paramount and the A-Leagues, how much money's going one way, how much money's going the other way, vice versa, yada, yada, it is still television that, in all sports, let's be honest here, in all sports governs a lot of what happens. So to me, that's what I think my reading of the situation was, that sort of, that's probably because the APL also doesn't have a lot of leverage, like maybe the AFL would with Channel 7 or something. That was the situation that we found ourselves in.
Let's stick with the Central Coast Mariners in Sydney. The match that was last Friday night, the Mariners got their nose in front, but the red cards are going to hurt Sydney. In particular, Lolly. He's looked like he's got 2 weeks from the match review.
Rodwell. Lolly's home.
Yeah, Rodwell, sorry. Yeah, 2 weeks. I mean, that's a big loss for them, but...
I would have, with Rodwell's health, I would have said Sydney are probably pretty used to playing without Rodwell at this point.
Yeah, that's true too. That's true as well. But having said all of that, you've got to dip your lid to the superlatives of Central Coast Mariners. I mean, they were unbelievable again. And we really can't say too much about how great they've been. And, you know, just to go through what they did over the last 3 weeks, let alone in the last 7 days, and come back to get that result. It was unbelievable for them, wasn't it?
I think the highest compliment that I can pay the Central Coast Mariners is that despite everything that they had to go through to get to that game, the travel schedule with the AFC Cup, the short turnaround from the final, getting back from Oman and getting back to play the game on Friday night, in that I think they would probably find themselves disappointed that they didn't win that game by more. To be honest, they've sort of set the bar, so to speak, whereas if I'm watching that game back, if I'm Mark Jackson, I may be not just happy to have escaped with a 2-1 win. I'm looking back at the footage and saying, oh, down to 10 men around the hour mark and then down to 9 men with about 10 to go, we probably should have put 3 or 4 past Sydney FC, not just got the 2-1 win. And I'm thinking maybe we shouldn't have conceded that goal to Joel King, because Sydney, I was perplexed by the lineup that Ufuk Tale ran out. It felt to me, especially considering that, as we talked about, the Mariners were coming off a very short turnaround. Sydney was the only team to have beaten the Mariners twice this season. It felt like the momentum was behind Sydney, but it was a very conservative 11 that was put out by Ufuk Tale. Girdwood Reich and Courtney Perkins, I think it was, in that midfield alongside Luke Bratton. It didn't surprise me that when Girdwood Reich had to go off with injury, another injury cloud, and Burgess came on, Max Burgess, Sydney looked a lot better. To the extent that I was thinking, why wasn't this the case from the start? But even with Burgess, they didn't create a lot. I think they only had 5 or 6 shots across the entire game. I think on the commentary call, Joel King's goal was described as hitting every branch of the ugly tree on the way down with all the deflections it took. So, like, if I'm the Mariners, I'm looking at that and saying, probably disappointed not to get a clean sheet and probably disappointed not to get maybe at least a third goal to take back to Gosford. And that we're saying this despite everything that the Mariners went through to get to that game, I think speaks to, just the what this team is doing right now and the accomplishments that made. To be honest, we're going to have a conversation about the Mariners and this underdog tag very soon, because at some point we're going to actually have to start labelling them the bully boys and the favourites in the A-League men.
Well, they just keep racking up the wins, and well, I think they're favourites going into the second leg. What does Sydney have to do? They have to reorganise, and they probably have to take a different approach to the game and get on the front foot as early as possible. So are you expecting a more vigorous, energetic and lively Sydney FC this weekend?
You'd be hoping for that. Certainly, if you are a fan of the Sky Blues, you'd just be hoping that, well, there is no tomorrow now. You have to go there and you have to beat the Mariners in front of what is, I think, is already been being reported as a rather large crowd, which will be hostile and partisan. You've basically got to go there and punch the Mariners in the mouth. You've got to go there. You've got to upset the apple cart. You've got to serve as the dream killers, the fairy tale enders, and you've got to be ruthless. You'd like to see the likes of Max Burgess come into the starting lineup. Jaden Kucharski, I think, would be a good one to bring in as well, give that a dimension. Lolly, obviously, is a massive out. But when you look at some of the youngsters they've got defensively coming through, Rodwell's presence will be missed, but I don't think it's as gigantic a blow as Lolly's absence. Corey Holman as well. Not the best player to lose. He's looking like a very good talent coming through. but you've got other players in the midfield coming through as well. So I really think for Sydney, it's just about you've got to sell out. You've got to go for it. You can't be cautious at this point. You go there and you get a 0-0 draw or 1-1 draw, that does you nothing. You've got to win. So you've got to play like that as well. Because you can't be, I wouldn't be banking on keeping a clean sheet against the Mariners in Gosford. And I'd be banking on them to score enough goals to counteract that.
Let's go to Amy Park on Sunday. Melbourne Victory, 20 shots on goal. Wellington Phoenix, 6 shots on goal. They were the official statistics. They sort of tell the story that Melbourne Victory might have dominated, but I never thought Wellington were in any real danger. They seemed to manage the game very well. Did you take it that way as well?
Yeah, well, it's now, I think, looking at those shots, Edge, I think they weren't credited with a shot on target either, Wellington, which means that they've now come to Melbourne twice, Wellington, not had a shot on target in 180 minutes of football and not lost, and somehow scored a goal as well in that first game as well, the own goal. For me, this was another game wherein maybe Melbourne Victory, you've got to imagine that the changes that were made, Brimmer not in the starting lineup, Arzani not in the starting lineup, Ben Falami for Nishan Volupele, I can see cases for both of them to start in a game like this, but Brimmer and Arzani coming out for Bonavazia and Selim Khalifi. It was just a few weeks ago that Khalifi and Bonavazia got a run in the last game of the season against the Wanderers, and I think the takeaway at the time, I think from a media event, was Tony Popovich, was that they probably wouldn't be starting in the finals, but now here we see them starting. So I have to think that was injury enforced. If it wasn't and it was tactical, I think it's clear that it probably didn't work. Victory sort of fell into the trap that they have a lot this season, in the sense that, as you said, a lot of shots, but none were really of high quality. I think maybe I can only really remember Alex Paulson, Wellington's fantastic young keeper, maybe looking a bit panicked once, and that was a long-range effort from Jordy Valadon that was more an error from Alex Paulson, maybe just misjudging things and having to double grab his save rather than anything regarding the shot. I did work it out looking at per the FOTMob stats that for all the Victory shots, when you actually average out their expected goals, it was just under 0.04 XG per shot, which Alex Paulson's been the best shot stopper in the league this season statistically. He's denied more saves than anyone else. What Wellington has accomplished this season, when you look at their number of their XG compared to their XG conceded and the way that they've outperformed both, it's completely unsustainable in the long run. And a lot of that has had to do with, I think, how good Paulson has been denying efforts. So in the long run, that's a problem. In the short run, 0.04 XG per shot isn't going to really beat Alex Paulson. So that was the problem that Victory ran into, quantity over quality. And now they've got to go to New Zealand. They've got to go to Wellington in what is likely going to be 34,000 odd Kiwis. And maybe Victory takes 200-300 over for a game like this. You'd be hoping, well, not hoping, but a club like Victory, you'd be, not hoping expectantly, hoping forlornly perhaps that they could, but it's going to be a hostile environment. It's the biggest game in Wellington Phoenix's history. They'll be riding that. And somehow, if you're Melbourne Victory, you've got to overcome that and upset the apple cart.
Yeah, it's going to be massive. My network in New Zealand tell me that it'll be the largest crowd of the season for Wellington. They'll be baying for blood. And I'm expecting an energetic performance from Wellington. It'll be interesting to see what Tony Popovich and his experienced players, how much they can handle over there and whether they can pull off what I would consider to be an unlikely win. So Wellington, for me, are the favourites, Jerry. Do you think Victory can do it? It's not so much can Wellington win. I think it's whether Victory can win.
I think Victory can absolutely win. In fact, it's the way this season has gone and the way Victory have played this season, the way that their ups and their downs, I would absolutely not put it past Victory to not only play badly, but beat Wellington tomorrow. They could play well and beat Wellington tomorrow, of course, as well. But this is a Victory side that could play badly, somehow jag a win over Wellington to get into the grand final, play badly in the grand final, and somehow jag a way to get a win over the Central Coast Mariners or Sydney FC as well. Probably the Central Coast. I think they have the edge there. It's just the way that this team feels to me. It's not an exact science, but especially like Tony Popovich, I just feel that he has it in him to send out a team to do it that way. And I think I've seen a lot of chatter around social media of Wellington Mariners fans and just general fans more broadly that think that, yeah, Victory probably actually could just somehow figure out a way to do this, even not playing well. It's just that sort of team.
Joey, we'll let you go there, mate. Comprehensive as always. Nice to get the necessary administrative stuff out of the way early and then just relax into a bit of a football chat, much too rare in the Australian game. So enjoy the second legs and the grand final to come.
Well, thanks for having me on, guys. Pleasure as always.
Joey Lynch, jdlmedia.substack.com. Subscribe, stay up to date. It's a no-brainer. Stick around. Rob Gilbert is going to be back and we'll be joined by The Athletic's Greg Evans.
Did you look after your mum on Mother's Day from Chemist Warehouse?
I did. I most certainly did. It was the Christian Dior at a bargain price.
Oh, well done. The beautiful Cheryl. She's a glamour lady at the best of times, let alone with fragrances from Chemist Warehouse. But now here's the time to start making some savings on other things in your life, Willem. You can stock up and save on all your favourite big brand vitamins at the annual Chemist Warehouse Mayhem Sale because it's May.
Yeah, I got it. Yep.
There you go, right now. All big brand vitamins are half price. That's half price on Blackmore, Swiss, Caruso's, LifeSpace, Go Healthy, BioGlen, Nature's Own, Synovus, and more. Now, I always get the Swiss Men's Ultivite. Don't start the day without it. I feel it just gives me that dose of energy in the afternoon, mate. I know you were over there in Amsterdam, but you took enough supplies to last you for a while. So what's your go-to set of vitamins to keep you up and about, mate?
It's the magnesium, Rob, the muscle relaxant, get a sore back, get a bit sore through the hips, and it's just no good getting out of bed and having to front the day aching. It's the last thing you want. You want to feel positive and enthused and vitalized. So the magnesium does an absolute treat. Doesn't take very long to kick in and you're flying down the street. Yeah. Off to attack the day.
And you'll sleep well at the end of the day as well. It's fantastic, the magnesium, and the cold and flu season is coming on as well. So get into Chemist Warehouse right now. Now, also remember, if you're on regular medication for chronic conditions like high blood pressure, cholesterol, or diabetes, you can save more on your prescriptions throughout the year at Chemist Warehouse. So get into Chemist Warehouse and find out how much you can save on those regular prescriptions. Find out more in store or at chemistwarehouse.com.au/prescriptions. Chemist Warehouse, discounting prescriptions with them every single day.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. And as we said off the top of the show, when the then manager of Aston Villa, who had promoted the club to the top flight, Dean Smith, was sacked, replaced by Steven Gerrard, it appeared that the inevitable was going to happen again and the club would be heading towards the championship. But who would have thought less than 2 years later that Unai Emery would have the Villa on the brink of the Champions League, a return to the Champions League, the title they so famously won in 1982. And our next guest covers the club every day and he joins us from time to time to talk about them. And he's from The Athletic, as many of our best regulars are. Greg Evans, how are you, mate?
Very good, thanks, Rob. Yeah, thanks for having me on. Obviously, a big night for Villa today. You know, they could get the job done tonight, and if not, tomorrow, if Tottenham don't beat Manchester City. So, yeah, looking like it's going to be a really good season for Villa already.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, as we all know in the world of podcasts, that you can't sort of hold time, can you? That as we speak, it's morning your time and Monday evening ours, and that game against Liverpool is going to be a defining one. Many of our listeners will already know the result by the time they tune in. So, I mean, I do want to go back to those early days. And, you know, as we prepared for the chat, I found an article on the the New York Times, and it's only published last week. The headline was "When a bunch of bloody Yanks came for English soccer," and the author Bruce Schoenfeld, he talks quite in quite a lot of detail about the ownership change of Villa under Wes Edens, who, as many will know, is also the owner of the NBA's Milwaukee Bucks with the Egyptian businessman Nassef Sawiris. And the fact that they so quickly managed to get the club into contention, but still, when I talk to my friend Cameron Dawson, who I've referenced on this show from time to time as the Villa fan, resident carer for my young Alexander, says that despite all the success, not all of the fans are happy with the management. I mean, could you explain to us how that could happen for a club that was on the brink of going down again, are still not entirely happy with the way the club's run?
Yeah, I think we have to take it back to just the period before Nassef Sawiris and Wes Edens took over the club, because Villa were in it's not sort of outlandish to say a very, very bad spot. You know, they were on the verge of administration. I was speaking to contacts who were telling me that Villa literally have hours to find a new owner, else they would be going into administration. You know, the position was that perilous. The money had stopped coming from China under the former owner, Tony Shah. And, you know, Villa had he had gambled the lot on promotion back to the Premier League. And it didn't work. And, you know, Villa were facing a third season in the Championship, which for, you know, Aston Villa is kind of unheard of. It's certainly in the Premier League era, you know, they'd never been down to the Championship since sort of the late 80s. And they were desperate to get back. Nassef Sawiris and Wes Edens, the two of them, you know, very, very successful businessmen, first and foremost, who have taken on distressed assets across various industries in the past and made them into better performing companies, recognised, you know, the potential at Aston Villa. They thought that they could come in and get a very good deal for the club and were able to do that. But their message from the very start is, look, we don't just want to come here and make a bit of money on this club. We really want to take the club far and see how we can go. And we hear a lot about 5-year plans in football, don't we? And 5-year plans in general. But if you look at Villa's, and the 5-year plan was to get close to competing for Europe again. I mean, it's almost the ideal sort of blueprint, isn't it? They got the owners managed to take the club out of the Championship in the first season, stayed up by the skin of the teeth the second season, established in the third and the fourth, you know, a few little bumps in the road here and there. And then the fourth season got into Europe and are now heading in towards the Champions League. So it's an incredible sort of 5-6 year period for the club. And a lot of it is down to the engaged ownership.
But those fans, as much as there are plenty of them, I mean, we read about some of the fans pushing back on some of the upgrades to the stadium, you know, and an abandoned ballroom being turned into a bar, and you know, some fans saying, well, I used to eat my sandwich down there, and are these things now issues of the past, or are they still being dealt with on a regular basis?
No, look, there are still some live issues. You know, among supporters feel like, look, they're going to be paying more for their season tickets next season. They're going to be paying more for tickets in general. You know, the club are moving towards trying to increase the hospitality areas, because I think across the Premier League now, what people, you know, in positions of power and in the board are thinking are that there are more types of supporters or people that are interested in going to games that want to have a ticket, but also they want a little bit of food before the game. They want to go and sit in a lounge before and maybe watch some football after. So it's gearing towards people who are prepared to pay a little bit more money. And for the, you know, the average Aston Villa fan, that's going to be quite hard, because I have lots of friends, you know, some who go on their own with their friends, some who go with their dads, some who go with their 3 or 4 kids or 2 kids. And it's really expensive to take a family to a game now. And tickets are going to be even more expensive next season. So it's issues like that that are still causing problems. But a lot of supporters do understand that if the club wants to go forward and continuing to back Unai Emery and getting good players into the club and competing for Champions League or at least European competitions, they have to increase revenue streams. And part of that will be to... part of that will be to ask for fans to pay for more, unfortunately, and that's just the way it is in football.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, we've seen, you know, some clubs fold and others, as we constantly see in the Premier League. I mean, we talked to Rob Tanner last week, and it looks like the Foxes are going to start the new season 6 weeks in the red, 6 points in the red, I should say. But then others, myself included, just can't understand how clubs like Manchester City can continue to kick the can down the road from their the allegations of their excessive spending, while Everton and Forest have to take their medicine immediately and are lucky to survive. But I guess there are other conversations and the balancing act. I mean, some say that that Villa qualifying for the Champions League might even rescue them from potential charges themselves.
Yeah, I think, look, the plan a couple of years ago was to try and increase revenue streams across the board. So what Villa could do first and foremost was try to bring in better partnership deals. There was a lot of controversy around the front of shirt sponsor, which was a betting company, but that was the best deal that Villa could get. Another area where they have to try and increase the revenue streams is by bringing in more money through supporters, by increasing season ticket prices and food and beverage around the stadium. Qualifying for the Champions League will bring in, I don't know the exact amount, but it's like bringing in a very big, you know, it's like a big player sale, for example. So it will prevent Villa from the need to sell one of their best players to help balance the books. And they're going to need to do that this season, because for 18 months now, I've been having conversations with people connected to the club, and they've always pointed towards this summer as being the really important one for them in terms of profit and sustainability. So it wouldn't surprise me also to see Villa maybe sell somebody who we don't expect them to sell. Now, I don't think that's because they have to sell at one of their best players. I just think that if you look across the real top clubs now, they always tend to sell a big player at the right time. And if it makes business sense, you know, I'm not for a second saying that Villa need to sell Boubacar Kamara, for example, because he's one of their best players, but they brought him in for nothing. So he's now worth 60 or 70 million pounds. If they were to sell him on and they back themselves to get somebody in who's an adequate replacement, that might make good business sense. Now, that's just one example I'm bringing up. You know, Ollie Watkins is going to be an incredibly valuable player now, having had the best season of his life. Would they consider a very big bid of, say, 70, 80 million pounds from another club? I don't know. But what I think we will see this summer is a player, or maybe two players, that we don't necessarily expect to leave. And what that will do, it will allow Unai Emery a little bit more freedom to bring in another player or two of his own and just continue to reshape and strengthen the squad.
Greg, onto the pitch. I want to take you back to March 10, Spurs against Villa. John McGinn belted Destiny Udogi off the park. Spurs won 4-0, and it looked like the battle for fourth was only going one way. But since then, not the case. How do you think, as a side under Unai Emery's management, they've roused themselves from what looked like a, you know, pretty key flashpoint to kick on and see out the season much stronger than Tottenham?
Yeah, I think when you look, the Europa Conference League campaign didn't go to plan in the end. You know, Villa lost in the semi-finals to Olympiacos. But if you look over the course of the season, before the semi-final game, Villa had played nine games since qualifying, and they'd only lost one directly after that game in the Premier League. So if you go back to the start of the season, what everybody was saying, and I remember speaking to Tyrone Mings on the last game of last season, and he said to me, our biggest challenge next season is to try and combine a European campaign with a Premier League campaign and be successful in each. And for a long period this season, Villa have done that. The one result that went badly for them was the Tottenham game. And I was looking at it thinking Tottenham have now got the advantage, but Villa went on and had very, very good results against Bournemouth. They beat Arsenal when nobody expected them to, and have just managed to maintain enough points in the Premier League to keep it going, and that's credit to them. I always thought at some point something would have to give, whether that would be in the Europa Conference League or the league form. But they've just about done enough, I think, to get into the Champions League. And Tottenham have had a little bit of a wobble of their own, haven't they? You know, had some really tough games lined up in the back end of the season, and perhaps were overachieving because they'd got a lot of their results against lower ranked teams. But what you've seen in more recent weeks is when Tottenham have played the bigger teams, they've really struggled.
And I'm not sure how often you field questions on the third choice goalkeeper, but we need to ask about our boy Joe Gauchy. He's been there for 6 months. He's behind Emiliano Martinez and Robin Olsen. Match day one next season, do you think he's on loan, on the bench ahead of Olsen, or where he is currently in third? How's he gone across the first 6 months, and how do you see his next 6 months playing out?
Yeah, it's a shame we haven't had a chance to see him. You know, thought maybe the Europa Conference League campaign might have given him a chance, but you know, look, that might be something for next season when Villa are going to be in Europe regardless. For me, Robin Olsen has never been an adequate backup for Emi Martinez, and I think internally Villa have recognised that they needed to strengthen the goalkeeping department, which is why, you know, Joe was signed. Don't know at this stage, but I do think that Olsen, at his age, would be looking to try and play regular first team football now, because it's been a while for him. And obviously Joe Gauchy is the guy that could come in and support him, Emi Martinez. But you've got to be a very strong character to be the number two to Emi Martinez, and you've got to understand that you're literally up against one of, if not the best goalkeeper in the world, and your moments are going to be few and far between. So he needs to be patient, and don't know too much about Joe, but maybe you could tell me more. But I presume he will be wanting to play as well.
Yeah, well, as you know, Australia's got a pretty strong pedigree with, you know, the likes of Mark Schwartz and Mark Viduka and a bunch of other goalkeepers. For some reason, we seem to sort of over-index on quality goalkeepers out of this country. So he's certainly highly rated, and given that Australia, with the expanded World Cup, are more likely to have an easier path to qualifying, he'll regularly be given opportunities to play in the green and gold. So, like a lot of other, you know, top flight Australian footballers, we're expecting him to be in contention for a long time to come, mate. Before we let you go, I just wanted to ask you a broader question about the changing nature of the top flight. I mean, admittedly, we may well see Manchester City go on to win a record fourth title in a row, first time ever if it happens. Arsenal will be the winner of this year's title if City can't get over the line. But when you look at that top 10 group of clubs, and even the next group out of them, with Villa starting to entrench themselves, and with a serious manager who's got international pedigree, are we seeing a changing shape of the regular contenders at the top flight? Is this an expectation that we ought to start to get used to, that, you know, for Manchester United, for example, sake, chasing the illusion of better days gone by, they may never come. They may always be a contender, but not necessarily at the constant top end of the elite. Should we expect to see the likes of Villa, Spurs, Newcastle, and, you know, even West Ham and some of the other clubs beneath them regularly contending over seasons to come, with financial fair play being more and more rigidly enforced?
Yeah, I think so. It certainly feels like the Premier League has become more split. It's almost two halves, isn't it? You know, you look at sort of the top eight or nine teams, and they're pretty much who you would always expect them to be. But the orders are changing a little bit now. I think Chelsea's a very good example. You know, since Roman Abramovich left, who would have expected Chelsea to not be competing for titles in recent years? And it just shows how quickly it can go wrong. So clubs are very aware of that now. You know, there'll be a day where Pep Guardiola leaves and Manchester City won't be as elite as they are now, and other clubs will have an opportunity. I'm sure when Manchester United rebuild that they'll start to get back to where they perhaps were in the past, but it's not going to be easy because, you know, Aston Villa have taken steps forward. Tottenham have taken steps forward. West Ham have been playing regularly in Europe and you know, are changing their own manager and hoping for brighter times in the future. And you've got clubs like Crystal Palace and Wolves, you know, and Brentford even, who have to think a little bit differently, admittedly, but, you know, are ambitious and get it right with a few good signings and things can quickly change. But there's a lot of money in the Premier League. We all know that. You know, the fact that four, maybe five clubs can get into the Champions League now is great motivation for some of those clubs up there. But at the same time, it's just so, so difficult to break into the elite, which I think makes Villa's story even more special, because 6 years ago, they were in the Championship, and just to re-establish themselves back in the Premier League is so, so difficult because there's so much time, there's so much catching up that they need to do. So, yeah, it just shows you get the right manager, a couple of good signings, things can change for the better.
Yeah, and hopefully if some of the chats that my friend Cameron tells me about, that maybe towards the end of his career even Jack Grealish might come back one day and end his days with the Villa, but that's many years down the track. Hey, mate, thanks again for coming on, Greg. It's always
pleasure.
Great to chat to you, mate, and good luck, I guess, with the final week of the season and Champions League football. How exciting is that?
Fantastic. Yeah, I mean, just a great season, isn't it? Villa would have liked to have topped it off with the Europa Conference League trophy, but overall finishing fourth and in the Champions League is more important, I think.
Yeah, you take that. Greg, stay well, mate, and until next time, mate.
Thanks very much, and love to Alexander, and do say hello to Cameron. You all take care as well.
Oh, thank you, Greg, and to your wonderful little Luca J, the eight-month-old mate. I'm sure he's got his villain kit all ready to go.
Tough man.
Okay, Greg Evans from The Athletic, great man, and great insights into what's going on. If you haven't read his copy on The Athletic, do yourself a favour and jump online. Okay, next, after the break, World Cup Corner on Box to Box.
Willa, 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 everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices. Everyone's going to save a dollar or two. Everybody's going to buy Hoyt's Spices, yeah.
Hey, Willem, the grapevine is telling me you've been out of discipline with your cooking over there. Is that true?
It is, and it's because I don't have access to the fine range of Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. I gave Edge one of the great assists of all time when I delivered that chili to him to Bangkok, and he's coming over here for the Paris Olympics, not too far from Amsterdam, and if he's thinking about not returning the favour, there might be some issues because my cooking hasn't been great and it needs a lift.
I think some of our listeners will be thinking chilies to Thailand, ice to Iceland, but we'll move right along from that because, you know, Edge is a quirky guy at the best of times and he does like, you know, certain flavour profiles. He might like that sort of more Mediterranean chili mix that the Hoyt's packs rather than that sort of Asian blast of heat that you get every time you have a feed in Thailand. I know all about that. Now, I'm making some risotto after we do the show tonight. And I'm not going wide with my range of spices, but I'm just using the, as we know, my classic four-colour peppercorn mix just to flavour it up with a little bit of white pepper powder as well, and the Himalayan rock salt as well. I get that in the grinder, and I just like those coarser, grindy flavours in the risotto as well, rather than the crappy table salt that you get from the supermarkets. That's no good, that stuff.
Yeah. No, that's absolute rot, Rob. I do remember seeing a little while ago a picture online. It was the Himalayan rock salt, 1,000-year-old product, and it was coming out of date, quick spot. You wouldn't get that sort of rubbish with Hoyt's, though. That is all time.
No, that's right. What's like? I mean, they do say that there's certain foods found in the pyramids, like honey, that was still edible after all those years, but didn't have a use-by date back then, funny enough. Anyway, we're getting a little distracted from the wonderful Hoyt's range of products that we always talk about from our good mate Johnny Accardo and all the Accardo family. If you haven't got down there, you get down to Coles, Woolworths or your local independent supermarket and fill your empty spice jar with Hoyt's.
Fill those empties with Hoyt's spices, yeah.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse. Great savings every day. And Hoyt's Herbs and Spices. Changing the mood of food.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
here, World Cup Corner. We talk a lot about the Matildas. We talked about Lydia Williams off the top of the show and, you know, the great scenes that we've seen in the past few years with the Matildas. But Edge, the young Matildas, is this a bad sign for things to come, or do these things just happen in the ebb and flow of competitive football around the world?
Well, we got stitched up by China and Japan, which I think the China result is disappointing. Japan results probably expected, but look, it's a bit of a concern because we've done poorly at the underage competitions of recent times. This under-20s team that qualified for the Women's World Cup have done so in an expanded format. They would have qualified directly because they finished third, which is a good result, but under the old format. But yeah, look, it's a concern because, you know, we all know that the Matildas depth is, you know, our first 11 is extremely good, and then it sort of starts to fall away. So to build depth, we need to get some good performances at these continental championships, because players get profiles and they get into bigger clubs and accelerate their development. So it is a concern. Yeah, it is a real concern. And I actually thought this group, which had, you know, three or four players that had really performed well in the A-League women's competition this season, could have been a group that might have done better, but sadly I was wrong.
What do you put it down to?
For those people that have watched the games, and probably not many have, but I have, the performances are quite poor. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you put it down to?
Well, I guess it's it's a bit of a reality check about where we're placed in the scheme of things, and how the NPL structure is getting players ready for those continental underage championships. You know, I think the people at Football Australia will probably say that, you know, when our talented youngsters get into out of the A-League women's competition and into the big competitions, like a Charlie Grant, for example, who's really accelerated her development, and Caitlin Torpy, who I understand is really accelerating her development too in the National Women's Soccer League. So, you know, once they get through to break it through into those sort of leagues, they develop quickly. So they tend to say that that's the more important channel than these continental championships. But, it's a worry. There's no silver bullet, no easy answer in the dialogue around this stuff. It's about resources and preparation and probably the strength, not so much the strength of the A-League women's competition, but the NPL competitions below that where these girls come from.
Yeah, and it's something that I'm going to expand on a little when we talk about the unintended consequences. Probably not the best way to describe it, but the existential threat that that this $1 million per club cut comes, and which players are going to be the ones that suffer the most. So
yeah, just a plug for Stoppage Time. I'm going to talk about my team of the week in Stoppage Time is the North Korean team in this competition, who scored 32 goals in three games. And we're a long way off them.
Yeah, Stoppage Time is where you're going to, because you look like you're ready to come off the long run and start giving.
No, I'm going
to
shut up, Rob. you give me the give for the listeners at home. Clip that, Rob's given me the eye all the way from Melbourne. It's reached me in Bangkok.
There were some discussions after last week's shows, and those just one more little one, please. Yeah,
in the corridor, in the corridors of power at Boxing.
Just those little ones. 3-0 to China. Oh, there's some heavy hitters in there, let me tell you. 3-0 to China, 4-1 to Japan, and if they needed a reality check, Edge, they got it if they read the Football Australia press release. Attention now turns to finishing the tournament on a positive note against Thailand. Oh, never good. Now, you exercise some top radio craft at the top of the show, Edge, with your little teaser about the Champions League, and if you've made it this far, it is now time. Real Madrid off the canvas. One of the great performances to roll Bayern Munich 3-2. They were trailing to Alphonso Davies' strike, and it was the oft-maligned 34-year-old striker Hossolu, not one who'll go down in the annals of great Real Madrid strikers, on loan from second-tier side Espanyol, who scored in the 88th and 91st minute, and that puts Real into an 18th final.
We're going to be talking about inches here.
No. Now, people say VAR is killing the game. Not the case with Hossaloo. Often there's a goal, you celebrate, then you need to go to the check, and then when it's confirmed, you might do a little fist pump or another hug or a high five. He was having his moment, Edge. He charged off for a second knee slide, teammates in tow. Yeah, really, really good stuff there. Their record in finals is 14-3. Not good news for Dortmund, who were through off the basis of a Mats Hummels masterclass at 35 years old. His header saw them further their first leg advantage over PSG. They are the 1997 champions into their third final. And the big storyline from their perspective is the young manager and how they botched the final day of the league last season and now can sort of redeem that to an extent. But it is also the final match for the much-loved Marco Reus, who at 34 will be moving on after 12 emotional seasons. He's had injuries. He's had things to overcome. He's not going to have that Bundesliga title, but the Champions League would be some pretty warm comfort, you'd think.
Oh, it certainly would. What a huge... I mean, those Dortmund fans are absolutely sensational. If you like a bit of fandom, get on Google and just put in Dortmund Ultras and just see some of the great work that they do in unison. Well, they're going to Wembley. They're going to Wembley in a big way. There's going to be absolutely thousands and thousands of them, as so will the Real Madrid fans, who we know it'll be yellow and black at one end and white at the other. It'll be a great spectacle. Let's hope that the Wembley Stadium management, Rob, have their shit together.
Well, we're going to talk about that also in Stoppage Time, which is going to be a conversation of a different type, of course.
The Netflix documentary that dropped, the final attack on Wembley. Every football fan should watch it. And if you're like me, listen to my long run on Stoppage Time.
But the management do come out, I think, looking okay. There's a whole bunch of other issues.
They reacted under the circumstances. They're under the pump, weren't they?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, it's going to be massive. And who does the non-partisan English football fan support if they've got a ticket to that game?
They don't like anything to do with Germany, do they? So, and they won't like Real Madrid because Real Madrid win it all the time. So they will be closing their eyes and tossing a coin, won't they?
I think you're right. But it's going to be a cracking final, that's for sure. So
how good are Dortmund? I mean, just as a club. I mean, seriously. I mean, they lose their best players every season. They really do, you know. And, I mean, what about the Bellingham story? I mean, he cut his teeth at Dortmund.
Well, they're the Central Coast Mariners of the Bundesliga, aren't they?
Well, they're probably a bit bigger than the Central Coast Mariners of the Bundesliga. But I just think as a football club, how they can reinvent themselves and remain relevant and competitive. And, yeah, they are to be admired. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, you're always playing second fiddle, despite the fact that they have been the second side for so long. And really, in German football, you're just waiting for Bayern to slip up. And maybe they got it together a little bit too late for that to be this season, because Leverkusen have just been phenomenal. But they've found a way to insert themselves. And if that comes in the form of a European title, well, that is the ultimate prize in some ways. So no, they're extraordinary. The young manager did the rounds, his tears post the final match day last year, and how within 12 months that can be well and truly rectified. So no, good on them. I'll be supporting them. Not that I particularly dislike Real Madrid, although you do get a little bit tired of seeing the same old result. 14-3 in finals. I couldn't get over that when I saw it, and that's why I've said it twice. But no, I think Dortmund, I would like them to win, although I do think they go in as underdogs.
Yeah, first time back since 2013 where they lost to Bayern. Okay, let's wrap it up there. Willem, thank you again, mate. Looking forward to another yarn in Stoppage Time later in the week.
Yeah, always more box-to-box on the agenda, Rob.
Edge, thank you.
Thank you, Roberto. Nice to see you back in the chair. Very, very good.
Thank you. And to Adam Maloney, thank you again, my friend. I know another Arsenal fan. We're surrounded by them.
Going down to the wire. We haven't even mentioned that. Arsenal 1, Manchester United 0 up at Old Trafford. Anytime you beat those mongrels up there.
Because it was awful. It was a stinker. I can't believe I watched the whole thing.
It was a stinker, but they got a result. Doesn't matter. They're still on top, and the pressure's on Manchester City, who've got to play Ange.
Big Ange, come on. One more effort.
Well, that won't be that. It'll be as, like, I'm not the first person to say this. I've heard it on a stack of podcasts. How Spursy would it be for them to beat City or even get a result against City and then lose to Sheffield on
if Ange Postecoglou beats Manchester City and Arsenal win the title as a result of that, he'll get his house fired on.
Yeah, exactly. So That's a problem. All right, come on. I was trying to wrap it up there, and you've started again.
So, yeah. Well, it's not. We don't have to. We're not making the news at the top of the clock, Rob.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Oh, here we go.
There we go. Starting again. All right. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, linesmen. Thank you, ball boys. Please subscribe to Box to Box, Stoppage Time and Offside, wherever you get your podcasts. Tweet us at Box to Box and follow us on X if you haven't already. Please also like us on Facebook and join us throughout the week as our podcasts drop and we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the world game.